its biology and its physiology. We don't have a good way to predict how it's going to make someone feel.
It's a human problem, and it affects everyone. It does not discriminate. It's widespread.
This episode is all about compassion and all about treating people with equality, respect, and love. It's all about harm reduction. So I sat down with Jay Hymas, who is one of our editorial board members. He is the owner of Clear Recovery in Cache Valley, Utah, and is also in long-term recovery himself. Jay told me some incredibly profound things about how addiction does not discriminate. I mean, there were multiple times during this interview that I was choked up because Jay was being so raw and was painting such a vivid picture of how people can feel when they are marginalized. Here's our conversation with Jay. Last week, with a couple of experts, an epidemiologist and a substance use disorder counselor, we talked about some of the, you know, like the social causes of substance use disorders and some of those risk factors.
Yeah.
So I thought we could just listen to little segments of that, and then we could talk about it.
Go in there.
Yeah. And you could share your thoughts and opinions about those segments. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Cool.
Also, just so we all know, these experts actually have names. So I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
Michelle Chapuse. I am a licensed substance use disorder counselor. I'm a member of the Ute Indian Tribe, and I work on this tribal rural opioid grant. I'm actually working with the tribes in the state of Utah to provide opioid education, but also naloxone and Narcan training to the various communities.
Cool. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
My name is Christy Peruznik, and I'm a professor at the University of Utah School of Medicine in the Department of Family and Preventive Medicine in the Division of Public Health. And I'm an epidemiologist, which means I don't take care of individual sick people, but I study the way that exposures and diseases happen in populations. And I've actually been studying the problem of prescription drug-related harm, particularly in Utah, since about 2004.
Cool.
Let's talk about some of those physiological, social, environmental causes of addiction. What kind of risk factors do we experience with these in our communities? What kind of sets a community up?
Well, when you think about the whole statement that, you know, this is not like me, I don't do this.
Yeah.
This is not my problem. I'm not the one that would fall into this category. I think that comes down to a lot of our social perspectives, especially in the state of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
Love the state of Utah, born and raised in the state of Utah. But we have such a moral lens when it comes to substance use.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always seen as a moral failing. Even though with the opioid issue and the issue that you were talking about was prescription opioids,
mm-hmm.
You know, nobody wants to be defined as a person who doesn't follow the prescription or who isn't more interested in their whole well-being versus I need to have this substance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when we start taking away a lot of the reasons why people are more likely to deny that there is a substance use problem.
Yeah.
We're looking at social, you know, social dynamics, social acceptance, social,
mm-hmm.
you know, how does this come across to my neighbor?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody
yeah.
wants to be defined as somebody who has a moral weakness when it comes to substance use.
Or anything, maybe.
Or any, I mean, this talks about any issue.
Yeah.
And this can even relate to, like, not just substance use.
Yeah.
But, like, our appearance, you know, keeping up with the Joneses. We've
mm-hmm.
all heard that term, right? What area of the valley you live in.
Uh-huh.
What part of the state of Utah you live in.
Yeah.
Job class. You know, we have all of
What do you mean by what area of the valley?
So, like, you know, we have West Valley.
Yeah.
We have, now I'm not from Salt Lake, but I spend a lot of time here in Salt Lake.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We have, like, the Avenues area. We
uh-huh.
have Foothills. You know, we have Murray, Draper,
uh-huh.
Rose Park area.
Yeah.
And I think so in society, we're so apt to putting people inside boxes
uh-huh.
that when it's like, oh, this is a problem that you'll see in this area, but
yeah.
not up here. So you can see how those types of concepts and those types of social structures kind of perpetuate
those
the belief
issues.
That, oh, You know, not in my backyard, not my son, not my daughter, mm-hmm. not me.
Yeah.
I'm following the prescription, you know, according to the doctor's orders.
Yeah.
It's just, it's, I think it's interesting how people can start to justify and explain away why they don't fit into that mold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Jay, we just listened to that segment that Michelle talked about, risk factors. What stories, what thoughts came to mind as you listened to that?
You know, it's kind of appalling to me to put people into different categories.
Yeah.
I truly believe addiction does not discriminate, and risk factors are, it's like a human problem.
Yeah.
Knowing the thirst that the opioids create, that you just, it completely takes over and overwhelms your every thought. That's what you, it's like a survival technique. You completely need that. And you know, I've seen people from every walk of life develop opioid addiction. My first encounter with someone was when I was 18. I got put in the Cache County Jail, and I had a cellmate who was actually a dentist and had prescription opioid use disorder problems with full extent of the law and everything else going on in his life.
Wow. So when you found out that he was a dentist, well, walk me through that moment.
It was really awkward, and it was like kind of hard to talk to him at first because I didn't understand. It was just like, whoa, hang on. It was kind of culture shock for me because I always did feel like, you know, there was like this certain part of the population or shamed or different or like one of these lower class people who just always had these kind of problems, like nobody else had problems.
Yeah.
But for him to come in and have these same kind of problems for me, it was really, really weird for me. But he was really open about it, and it was really cool to see that, to feel human, right? To feel like that equality in life was, you know, I'd always ask him real weird questions, and I just really was intrigued. And at some point, I just wanted to talk more to him, and I just always asking him questions like about his family and things. Uh-huh. And it was just weird that it was, everything seemed so picture perfect, yet he was my cellmate.
Wow. What did that do for you emotionally when you... when you recognize that, you know, that you too were human and that you weren't any different than, say, a dentist or a doctor or anybody else that, you know.
It changed the way I viewed, like, I guess, people, or like if you want to classify like rich people or poor people, you know, it changed something inside of me that I'll never forget. It was like an equality in life for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I started to grow a little bit from there. Of course, my personal story, the opioids and substances took over, and I still had that thirst for a long time. But I'll never forget that feeling of just see that, not just in the poverty people, not just in the poor people, my people, or whatever you want to classify them as, people in jail, homeless, or worse, right?
Yeah.
And it always stuck with me, and it still does today.
Wow. So addiction, substance use disorders do not discriminate.
Absolutely not. I've witnessed, you know, people from all walks of life coming in, and it's a beautiful thing to be able to help them and kind of to just mix the diverse population like we do, because we're private and we're also court mandated classes that come in. So we're mixing those people and kind of getting them in together and talking and stuff. And it's really cool to see the conversations that come out, because it's creating equality and opening the door to, like, this is a human problem. This ain't like, I'm not any different than the next guy. It's just, it's widespread and it's growing.
Yeah. It's a human problem.
Yeah.
It's a human problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Michelle was talking about different neighborhoods in Salt Lake City and Salt Lake Valley. And, she talked about one neighborhood up on the hill, and she said something, you know, hypothetically about somebody saying, oh, but not up here. This isn't going to happen up here. Yeah. What did you think when she said that?
I just kind of chuckle, because, you know, what I know now is that's not true. Like, it happens on the hill. It happens in your backyard. It happens to your neighbors. It happens to your friends. I think today that, you know, the opioid epidemic has affected almost everyone's life in one way or the other, whether it's a friend or you heard someone's friend or something.
Or a family member.
Yeah, or, you know, it's affecting everyone, and it's starting to be more talked about. Mm-hmm. It's a real awkward conversation. I know that, like, localized here, when we set up booths at the fair and stuff, people, you know, when you're approaching them, they're like really shut off. They're like, whoa, I've actually had people like, we don't have these kind of problems around here. Like, what are you doing? And I'm like, okay,
So why is it awkward?
It's awkward for them because they feel like there's not a problem, right? Yeah. Like, what are you doing here? Like, I feel like they think I'm out of place or something. And it's just growing so rapidly. What you don't see behind closed doors is scary.
So do you feel when you're in those situations explaining to somebody who doesn't really think there's a problem or just, you know, out tabling, do you feel like there's a lot of stigma?
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of empowers me to be that voice, right? To be able to be that voice with the awkward conversation saying, yeah, here I am. Like, this is happening, you know, and whether you want to acknowledge it or not, maybe someday soon you'll see it and you'll think of that time when we had the conversation and hopefully it shines a little bit of light. Start the conversation, right?
Yeah.
The conversation needs to start somewhere and people need to talk about it more. So then people aren't so shamed and stuck in it. Right. Because the keeping up with the Joneses kind of feeling, right? To have people there, that I think that's what keeps people so stuck and shamed and hidden, is they don't dare come out because of the judgment and everything else that follows.
How did that judgment affect you personally?
Oh, horribly. That was the worst. Like, you know, when I first started coming out of my addiction, you know, they're asking like fears and things like that. And that was the hugest one, was being judged. I just don't want to be judged. I just want to feel like you. I just want to feel like her. You know, I want to feel like a part of society. I don't want people to judge me for what I've been through and all that. I just want to be able to be okay. And it was hard. And being honest, I found, you know, being honest in my story and being vulnerable and telling people, I ran into people who like literally slammed their doors. And I also ran into people who like wanted to hug me and cry with me and cheer me on. So it's, you know, I think being honest and open about it has been a huge part of being, not being so shamed or feeling so judged. It's just like, here I am, you know, and being that voice has kind of sent me on the path where I'm at today. Just keep on airing that voice and being that voice.
Can you tell me about how you felt when somebody slammed the door or closed off a relationship?
I was pissed off. Yeah. It really got under my skin and I like, how dare they? And then, you know, I would talk to others and my wife and things about it. I was told by a friend of mine, you know, it's none of my business what they think.
Yeah.
And it's not up to me to be judging them for judging me. So that was kind of a huge milestone in my recovery, was just kind of let, you know, people are going to be that way. You run into them in all walks of life and trying to understand that a bit.
Yeah.
But it felt horrible. I felt alone.
Was it demoralizing?
Yeah, definitely. I felt that huge stigma, right? I was just like penalized. Like, how dare you?
Right.
Like, I'm trying, you know, and for people to slam the door or turn you down for a job or an apartment and things like that, for it's very hard. It's very damaging to people who are trying to recover and gain something different.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, oftentimes it would send people back out. Give up, right?
It's just this cycle, that negative feedback loop.
Yeah.
So talk us through then how it felt when somebody didn't slam the door and they embraced you.
It put tears in my eyes. Like, I literally started crying. There's a lady, our storage shed was locked. This is the story I like to tell. Our storage shed was like double locked. I just got out of rehab. All my clothes and things and hygiene, like everything, shoes, everything that I didn't have in my little bag was in that storage shed. And I just went in. At first I tried playing. I was beating on the bush. I've been in the hospital. You know, I didn't really dare say it. But finally, I just like, you know what? I just got out of rehab. Like, I just really need my stuff. She said, it'll be unlocked in 2 hours. Thanks for being honest. And you can get your stuff and you can pay me later. I know you'll make good. Keep going. And like, I started bawling. I mean, I did. It's making me tear up right now because it was such a huge moment in my life. Like, at that moment, I felt like I could be okay. You know, I'm like, wow, this lady, like, I just told her that she's a normal member of society. And I just told her that I went through this and she's caring. You know, she let me get my clothes. You know, that mattered to me. You know, another time, a boss, I told him, I started out with him and it was like really awkward because I was just getting back into the workforce and I'm like doing my best, like running to work, making sure I'm there on time, doing everything I can to be there. And I told him one day, I was like, look, you know, I've been through a real rough past and I'm going to put all my effort into this job. Like, I really want to keep this job.
Yeah.
And he's like, ask me, what do you mean? I says, well, I've been severely addicted for 22 years to drugs and opioids. And he looked at me and it was really uncomfortable for a minute. And he's like, oh, I don't really understand addiction, and wanted me to talk a little bit more about it. So I told him, and then within a week, he gave me keys to a truck. Like, he trusted me.
Yeah.
He believed in me. He gave me raises on time. He treated me like he would any of his other employees, and it mattered. It felt so good.
Was that one of the first times somebody had trusted you like that?
Yeah. Yeah, that was like, I never knew trust like that. And that was like a really profound moment to me, to be trusted and with someone else's like work vehicle. Yeah. And you know, it was cool. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. The huge point I want to deliver is opioids. Drugs do not discriminate. You know? Yeah. They don't.
All right, let's go on to the next clip. So, Christy, can you tell us about the dependence, like how the dependence occurs and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we know that particularly for opioids, that dependence, physical dependence, can start very quickly. And somebody who is prescribed with, you know, 14 days or 30 days of opioids, say following a medical procedure or a broken leg, if they actually took all of those medications as prescribed, they would be dependent on that drug, because dependence can start in like 9 days. And that's very, very quick. The other thing is that...
What happens if someone's dependent on a drug? What does it look like if they try to stop and things like that?
Well, so it means that that drug or that medication is changing the way that that person's body chemistry works.
Yeah.
So that then if the medication is not present, then the body starts to feel off, like dysregulated, like something is missing.
Yeah.
And that doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in those first early days, it wouldn't be what we think of as like a severe withdrawal kind of a symptom, that, you know, they wouldn't start throwing up and sweating immediately.
Okay.
But the person's brain and their body would say, oh, wait, no, I missed that. I still want that.
Yeah. Maybe I need that.
Yeah. I mean, because that's what, when we start taking that, then we're putting it into our bodies and teaching our bodies to expect it.
We just listened to a bit about dependence.
Yeah.
And tell us what you said about dependence.
So it becomes a thirst. Like, you're super thirsty, super dehydrated, and nothing can fix it but that. The best way I can describe it is like an itch deep down inside my ear that nothing can scratch but that pill or that next fix. And you can imagine, and we've all had the ear itch, right? You can just imagine not being able to scratch that itch. And that's what the opioid fixes, right? It'll fix that. It's like a fix-all.
Gosh, it's making me itchy, like, thinking about it.
Yeah.
Christy just told us about dependence and how prescribing practices kind of lead to dependence. Mm-hmm. What did you think when you heard that?
The overprescription. Like, every time I've encountered someone with a prescription, they've always had extras. Always. And they would like either sell them or be abusing them themselves and trying to plot and plan how they can get more and run out faster. And it almost never failed. They could go right back to the doctor or dentist or whatever and come back with more. And it was just like, cool, great. You know, and that's the sad truth.
So I'm about to ask Jay about his recovery and how prescribing practices affected him personally. I ended up using the phrase, get clean. This is common language, and I use this phrase because Jay and I were speaking conversationally. However, I need to point out that the phrase, get clean, especially when used by somebody like me who doesn't use drugs, can be really stigmatizing. It sort of suggests that people who use drugs are unclean, unworthy, or somehow less than. The reality is, people who use drugs aren't bad people. They are not dirty. They are not less than. They just use drugs, and that doesn't make them less human. So, for now on, when speaking about recovery, I'm going to work on not using the phrase, get clean. When you were trying, you know, when you first started looking at recovery, and you wanted to get clean, was that a problem? You know, was it difficult because you knew, you know, these prescribing behaviors existed?
Yeah, it was. It was like the access, right? Just being able to access, just knowing that I get out and it'd be right there again, and everything's just so openly in my world, it was just everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah, the prescribing factors and along with the illicit factors like heroin and things and meth and everything is just so readily available to if you know where to look, like you can just get it, you know. And that was scary for me. It was really scary for me.
Yeah. Gosh. Out of everyone that you've encountered who has an opioid use disorder, how many of those would you say started with a prescription?
Oh, I would dare say 80% easy.
Wow. Yeah. So a lot, a majority.
Yeah. And oftentimes when you run into people that's already on to heroin and bigger, better things and you don't ask those kind of questions.
Yeah.
But from the ones that I do know and have had talks with about, it's the majority of them for sure.
Wow. All right, let's go on to the next segment.
If you have a prescription for 15 to 30 days, whatever, of an opioid, and you take all of those, you will become dependent.
That, right,
likely.
That if you, you know, if you really took that every day for 30 days and then you stopped, you would probably have withdrawal.
No matter if you lived in Highland or West Valley,
exactly.
Or foothills.
It doesn't matter if you are white or black or old.
You have a huge house or a small house.
Exactly.
No, it's biology and it's physiology. And we also, about opioids, we don't have a good way to predict how it's going to make someone feel. And it seems like this is one of those things that they estimate. It's a rule of thirds, right?
Okay.
So there's like approximately a third of people who take an opioid the first time and they hate it. Like it makes them feel sick. They feel like dizzy. They say, I never want to take that again. I don't care how much pain I'm in.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? There's a third of people who are like, whatever. Like, took the pain away. I'm fine. And then there's like a third of people who, you know, may have that first dose of oxycodone after their broken leg.
Uh-huh.
And their brain is like, whoa, where has this been my whole life? And we don't have a screening test to be able to, you know, look at you or me or Michelle and know how our bodies are going to respond to that medication.
Uh-huh.
And if we did, it might go a long way to help prevent people from going down a path that leads to dependence and then maybe to substance use disorder.
Yes.
Yeah. Because
if we knew that I was at high risk for like loving opioids,
then you wouldn't take them.
Then a physician might say, you know what? Instead of sending you home from your knee operation with an opioid, how about if we try a nerve block?
Yeah.
You know, or some other means of pain control.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an open area for research.
So how did that segment make you feel?
It made me chuckle again. Like, it's true. You know, it don't matter, black, white, rich, poor, you know, driving a Beamer or walking. Like, it does not discriminate, and it's super widespread, and I think the conversation needs to be had more because it is true. You know, I've seen it all, and it's scary.
Yeah.
You know, I think people need to become more vulnerable if they feel like they're having a problem and set more firm boundaries with the doctor. Like, ask the question, hey, am I going to become dependent upon this prescription? You know, and maybe go through the pain a little bit. You know, it's probably worth going through a little bit of pain than a severe addiction.
So do you think that you, right there you said, if somebody thinks they're having a problem, they need to talk to the doctor about maybe not prescribing that. Do you think that we should set up some systematic things to maybe stop those problems before somebody even has to think about it?
Yeah. You know, I think that would be awesome, really, because the vulnerable people, you know, people unsuspecting, all of a sudden, you know, they're super thirsty for this pill.
Yeah.
And it just completely takes over their life.
Yeah.
You know? And like I said, you're uneducated. You don't know what's going on. If there's education out there and it was more like, hey, beware, right?
Yeah.
Like, buyer beware. You know, everyone knows about alcohol, like the effects and things, and it's more widespread. And I think opioids should be right there. Right?
So Christy said something about when people get a prescription from a doctor, sometimes they see this doctor or this dentist or whoever's prescribing as an authority figure, mm-hmm. and that they have to take this prescription.
Yeah.
What did you think when she said that?
I've been in that situation, and I thought, you know, they need to be able to stand up and ask that question. Education, right? I've went through I had my wisdom teeth taken out, and the dentist was like, here, we're going to give you some opioids. And I just like, no, I went through it without them. So I just a little bit of pain is worth it.
Yeah.
To rather than a severe addiction. It's, I see what you're saying with the authority figure, because yeah. they're writing this prescription. You feel like you should take it, right? Like,
yeah.
oh my gosh, like this is my health, right? It's, you're trying to take care of yourself, but yeah. in doing so it's hindering. It can be hindering.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always a hard,
yeah.
hard thing to balance, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Pain is uncomfortable, but the pain will still be there when you stop taking that pill, and that's going to be really uncomfortable as well. So I feel like you're just adding fuel to the fire.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, when Christy talked about withdrawals and talked about how, you know, if you have a 30-day prescription and if you take that 30-day prescription, you likely will become dependent and could experience withdrawals. What did you feel there? What did you think when you heard that?
I 100% agree with it. The word withdrawal makes me cringe in my bones because it's not fun, and it's true. If you're using opioids for 30 days, you're going to need a taper.
What do you mean that it's not fun? Because for someone who hasn't experienced withdrawals, we don't get it.
It's like someone's got you by the head and by the hips and just kind of twisting, uh-huh. and you feel like you're just, it's like near death experience kind of stuff. Okay. That's how I describe it. It's like someone's wringing out your spine, and uh-huh. You feel it in every limb, and you're just pain. It's just like pain. It's worse than like the original pain that you may have been going through.
Worse than the original pain that you may have been going through.
The withdrawals. I would dare say that it is definitely worse.
Wow. Wow.
And it's more, and then you've got the mental part as well, like that calling, that thirst, the itch in the ear that I spoke of. Like, so it's just.
Earlier, when we listened to the part about Michelle saying that this isn't a moral failure, did you ever feel that you had failed morally or that you had, you know, fallen short because you were using?
Yeah. You know, I felt different, and I felt like, ashamed to be myself.
Felt shame.
Yeah. You know, I felt ashamed of who I was, and I would never want to look someone in their eye and be comfortable with other people who weren't on that level, I guess.
Yeah, Jay just did air quotes for us.
Yeah.
What do you mean, like, we're not on that level?
Like
the air quotes.
Like, again, the stigmatizing factors, right? Like, and I don't want to be the one who's stigmatizing, but, you know, when people who weren't using with you or you knew were also from poor families or from that side of town kind of thing, or you were unsure where, like, they fit into society.
Yeah.
It's like almost like cop crook kind of thing, right?
And did you feel like you were, what side did you feel like you fit in?
Well, the crook, you know, I felt like I didn't want to talk to like the grocery store clerk, even down to like that kind of stuff.
Really?
Walk into the grocery store. Hey, can I help you find your part? Nope, I'm good. Like to that level, you know, of just.
Because of the shame and the fear.
Yeah. Like I literally wouldn't ask or answer, you know, let the auto parts counter help me find the screw that I need. I would go search myself because I just didn't feel. Just felt so different.
Gosh.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But you feel different now.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I just, you know, I found a light inside of me, and I asked myself the question what it would look like one day if maybe I got clean and wasn't using drugs and wasn't stuck on the streets. And I that little question, you know, started coming up more and like desperation, despair, just like wanted something new. Wanted to try something different. My grandma always told me that you're going to be a good man. Like you're going to make a difference in this world. And going through what I've went through, I think I went through it for a reason. You know, I can accept it today so I can help the next person and just shine light on the topic and stand at the fair and say, here I am. You know, I was addicted. I'm a person in long-term recovery. Yeah. I'm doing it. You can too.
So, do you think that, people who use drugs are bad people?
No. They're maybe uninformed people. Circumstantials sometimes fall in there. You know, I think they're really good people. In fact, people who have used drugs and become addicted to drugs are some really good people.
Like, so if somebody is using right now and they are feeling so much shame and stigma like you were feeling before, but they didn't want to look even the clerk in the eye, what would you tell them?
There's hope. You're a good person. I believe in you.
Let's just take a second and sit in what Jay just said, because it's so profound. In fact, you know what? Let's just listen to it again.
There's hope. You're a good person. I believe in you.
Cool. All right, let's go on to the next segment.
You may feel like, oh, the doctor said I should take this, so I'm going to take it and I'm going to keep taking it because you are in a position of less power and you're worried that the doctor maybe won't treat you again or something else if you didn't follow instructions, right? Whereas somebody else who's like, no, I hate this. I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm not going to follow that instruction because they may feel like they have more choice in the matter. And, oh, well, if I can't go to that doctor, I may go to another doctor. And, you know, we may think about this in terms of people of more privilege or less privilege. But then, you know, let's think about a situation in a more rural community where there may only be one provider. And if you need to maintain a relationship with that person, then that could turn into a very difficult conversation.
So did you ever feel that way?
You know,
talking to a doctor and...
I've felt that pressure from a doctor before, and they're like, you know, just talk me through the prescription. Like, right, here's your prescription. And if you think about it, like someone, they're giving you antibiotics. Of course, you know, you trust them, right? It kind of ties in there. So I'm trusting this person. And then all of a sudden... Now I'm like at their mercy, begging for more kind of thing. And I've seen that happen to multiple people. And I've been in a situation where I've set boundaries with doctors and I've had them be appreciative of that as well.
Can you walk us through a moment when that happened?
Yeah. So I had a big metal plate hit my leg and it was really extremely painful. And I went to the physician and I was just like, I just want x-rays. I want to make sure. Cause it felt like, I mean, it slid all the way down my leg. It was bad. Ouch. So I was worried there may be some fracture. I went in and they're like, you know, in severe amount of pain, asking where's your pain scale 1 to 10, you know? And I'm like, probably an 8. And like, I was like, literally couldn't walk on it. And, the physician had said, you know, I don't think it's broken, kind of moved it around a bit. And he says, you know, I can give you a prescription for some muscle relaxers and some opioids, some painkillers until it heals up a bit. And I says, well, hang on. I don't want the opioids. Is there an alternative? And he asked me why. And so I'm like, okay. So right there, right? It was really uncomfortable. And I just flat out told him, because I've been severely addicted to opioids for a long extended period of time. And he was thankful that I told him that. But at the same time, it triggered me, right? It was really like, it was the first thing out of his mouth. And of course I wanted to accept it. And of course I wanted to follow the doctor's orders, right? It's a doctor, right? Everyone, you know, oftentimes you hear in recovery, like, I've heard people say anyway, not oftentimes, I've heard people say like, I can't wait for that next car crash or that next tooth pull because then I get my, you know. And so that's kind of the sad truth of it as well. You know, it's hard to set boundaries when you've got that thirst to still a little bit and then they're just like first thing ready to hand you more and it's, yeah.
Do you think docs or anyone prescribing, do you think they should just ask everybody, have you ever used opioids? Like, no matter what they look like, who they are, do you think it should just be a standard question?
I think it would be helpful. Yeah. Especially, I think they should ask that before they say, here, do you want some? You know, kind of thing. Or maybe explore alternatives, right? Take some ibuprofen, maybe ice it, elevate. I don't know. There's such a broad view on pain, right? It could be pain inside, pain outside. You know, I think that they should definitely explore more options of more... natural ways to deal with pain. You know, maybe make them tough it out a day or two, you know? And that's ultimately what I ended up doing. And it was okay. You know, it sucked. I still went to work, you know, but it was hard.
But it was okay.
Yeah, it was okay.
You didn't have to deal with the opioids.
Yeah, and I didn't have that pain of the withdrawal. Like, I didn't have nothing to worry about. I felt it was really empowering, and it felt really good to set that boundary. But it wasn't easy.
Yeah. So what kind of advice would you give to people who are trying to set boundaries?
You know, advocate for yourself, speak up, you know, ask questions, educate yourself. You know, Google's not always the greatest because you can find several different answers, but, you know, education,
Yeah.
Educate yourself on what you're taking and what you're putting into your body and side effects and all that stuff.
So what do you think when you hear the myth, good people like me don't become addicted to drugs?
That's just that. That's a huge myth. That's, you know, completely false. And I think that that even being said is creating more of a problem, uh-huh. because then it's, you feel like this good person that could never be addicted, and so you don't want to admit that you're addicted. You just want to keep going to the doctor and just stay there until, you know, jail or worse, death.
Yeah. And I think it's important to point out, if somebody becomes addicted to drugs or anything, that does not mean that they are a bad person. Mm-mm. That does not take away their good person right. title.
They're human.
Yeah.
They're human.
Yeah.
That's how you know you're human, is because it's a human problem, and it affects everyone, and it does not discriminate. It's widespread. Yeah.
What else do you want to tell us about that myth? Do you have any, like, burning thoughts?
No, I think that, you know, we've hit on some really key points. You know, it is a myth, in my opinion. It's something that needs to be talked about more. And if mm-hmm. you ever hear someone out there talking about opioids, approach them, talk to them, ask them yeah. questions. You know, don't be scared and don't feel ashamed. You know, I put the number, our phone number, in as big as I can across the front of our booth, because people don't want to walk up and admit they have a problem in front of, you know, we're rural. Anyone. You know, you see your neighbor right there, and all of a sudden you're shamed, right? Like, I do that on purpose, so you don't have to come and right? Yeah. Front page of the paper yeah. kind of stuff. And you can find help privately. You don't have to go to jail. You don't have to get busted, you know. And of course, that's usually where it lands, because mm-hmm. people are so scared to come out and say, hey, help me before it's too late, or I don't have a problem, right?
People are so scared to come out and
fear.
Ask for help.
Yep.
Why do you think that is?
Just that judgment, you know. I think that's huge, huge factor. You know, what are the neighbors going to think? How are they going to treat me when I get to this facility? Am I going to be, like, down there with one of, you know, people that I don't fit in with? Or, yeah. or you know, am I going to fit in? Are they going to accept me? Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and you just let love light the way, and you can find a lot of love in a lot of these private facilities.
Cool. So you grew up in Logan.
Yes.
In Cache Valley. I know we're not considered rural by some definitions, right. but by others, it'd be hard not to call it rural sometimes.
Right, yeah.
What were some of the unique challenges that you faced living in a rural community and having a substance use disorder?
Just kind of everybody knowing everybody kind of thing, you know, and not trusting and not being able to, like, that fear, right? Not being yeah. able to admit it without, like, going to jail or, you know, being kicked out of class or whatever mm-hmm. it is. Not, like, no resources and no one, felt like no one who cared.
So you felt like you couldn't get away from that stigma?
Yeah. Yep.
What would that have done for you had you been able to get away from the stigma?
I think it would have, it would help me a lot if I felt safe, if there was someone who I felt safe with that I could tell
yeah.
things. And like, I recently took a training for peer support
uh-huh.
and it's, if I had a peer that would have been there for me or could have been there for me to say, hey, let me help you. Yeah. I think that would have made a huge difference. So just being, you know, spreading help, you know, and opening that up, that peer support specialist, I want to shine light on that. That's amazing. You know, being the owner of this business, it's kind of stigmatizing as well, because people treat you different a little bit. But uh-huh. I took that training to be, I want to stay in the group. So I want to stay down on with people who are struggling. I want to be there for them
yeah.
and keep that paying forward, because I think that, you know, that's what I'm meant to do.
Yeah. So imagine a perfect world where there is no stigma, and when people meet somebody who has an opioid use disorder or any sort of substance use disorder or other disorder, and instead of being met with stigma, they're met with compassion
and love.
Love. They're met with, like, harm reduction or other practices mm-hmm. that
yeah.
approach that, you know, that compassion. What kind of a difference do you think that would make?
Oh, that would make all the difference. I think that would be you know, you see someone struggling, you know, diabetes, you know, you're like, people are generally concerned, you know, and they want to help, you know. I think it needs to be the same, you know. It's equality, right? And it's uh-huh. I think that would be beautiful. You know, fighting addiction with love is the best tool you've got, you know. So if you know someone struggling, help them, you know, love them, don't judge them, you know, they're people too.
Obviously, you all just heard Jay's story, and if you're like me, you were moved by it. But I just need to point something out here. You know, Jay's story, in a way, isn't that unique. The feelings that he experienced of being less than human or being somehow a different, less important, less valued type of human, these feelings are all too common. And we, humans, people all over the world, we need to do something about this. And I think our first step is harm reduction. Though we didn't talk today about medication-assisted treatment or other more widely known components of harm reduction, this episode was all about harm reduction because it was all about compassion. When we treat people with compassion, equality, respect, and love, we are practicing harm reduction. So please, go practice harm reduction. Today, we were joined by Jay Hymas, Michelle Chapuis, and Dr. Christy Peruznik. Each new episode launches on the second Wednesday of each month, so join us on April 8th when we debunk the myth that addiction can be cured by willpower. Debunked is produced in collaboration with Utah Public Radio. Funding for the show comes from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement, and Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield. Special thanks to KCPW in Salt Lake City, Utah, for lending us their studio space. Our editorial board is Jay Hymas, Adam Baxter, Ashanti Mortiz, Savannah Ely, Dr. Sandra Solzer, Dr. Suzanne Previdel, Dr. Aaron Fanning Madden, Mindy Vincent, Patrick Rizak, Michelle Chapuis, Dr. Maren Voss, Dr. Amy Kahn, Trisha Glass, Lloyd Arrive, and Hilary Deesh. Debunked is produced by Nick Porath, Shalane Smith Needham, and Friend Weller, with Nick Porath serving as lead producer. Our creative specialist is Autumn Gibbs. Music for today's episode was created by Nick Porath and Aaron Rollins. Our science advisor is Dr. Aaron Fanning Madden. And our program directors are Dr. Sandra Solzer and Dr. Suzanne Previdel. I'm Tim Light, host and editorial board member. You can find the show on the podcast app, Spotify, upr.org, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Check us out on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube at DebunkedPod, or on our website at bit.ly/debunkedpod.